Hello.
Well, we are now in the third part of a series of reflections on sexuality. In it, I basically recapitulate how I thought that I needed to look into sex to understand what's going on and how I was misinformed and how I needed to relearn all of it. And the first part of this part is about why is it that sex is regarded as a problem. My conclusion was that simply that some people try to make you believe that sex is a problem because then they can manipulate you. If you go beyond that, and that's the second part of the story, if you look at what sex actually is, then it is a development of consciousness in life on Earth, and that encompasses all forms of life on all of Earth, and all of these life forms are interconnected by the DNA that they share via the food chain, and so they all learn from each other and they all exchange information, and in some cases they make that exchange of information very specific and very selective and very precise. And so over the ages you can see in the biology of sex that, for example, the pollination of flowers by the wind, or the fertilization of fish by the sperm being flushed over the eggs of the other fish, or the development of pollination with insects and birds and other means led to a very refined technology of the relationship between the penis and the vagina in some of the species, where that led to such a precise fit and such a precise matching that the insertion of the penis into the vagina actually became a process in itself. And it is that process which I now would like to go into. But as usual, I would need to give a bit of a context before that, because on the one hand, I want to show how it works in our body, which is this part of the story, but I also want to explore and explain how it works in our mind, specifically our collective mind, which will be the next part of the story. So this story is essentially about the sexual interaction, the sex act, as people would call it, or the coitus, as people might also want to call it. And again, whatever you want to call it, realize that there is no reason to have any charge to the meaning of the words that are used to describe this. Do realize that whatever charge there is on the words describing sexuality originate from this politics of the suppression of sexuality to manipulate people. And in some extent, there was a good purpose for that, because sexuality only works if it is respectful. And that is described in the story of freedom of choice and respect and responsibility and reliability. So you need to have a healthy relationship. So outgo the Roman rapists and their laws, which say that what they do is proper, right and proper. And in comes the understanding that essentially the female is the being who can continuate life, and in that sense is the guardian of life, and in that sense could be the selector of which life is to be continued. And at some point I wrote a story called In Praise of Prostitution, which was about the sexual initiation priestesses as they were active, say 10,000 years ago, in which the young lad would go to the temple and learn, first of all, that the universe has all of the principle of sexuality in it, because it's the relationship between information and matter. Secondly, that over on Earth you can see that all of nature is based on this principle of sex, which is the complementarity of complements, opposites, that opposites are two parts of the same story. So you go from duality thinking to integrity of thinking. And the third part was that in that sexual initiation, the guys would learn that sexuality is something to do, to be done with care and with caution, that it is not something to be done lightheartedly and out of ignorance. You actually need to learn what it is, and that goes way beyond just knowing how to connect the penis into a vagina, right? To put a vagina around a penis. It is much more about being able to understand the sequence of consequences that come out of that. So in a way, it's like learning how to play with fire, or how to use a knife, or how to use fireworks. You need to be able to foresee the consequences before you start, and that's where our culture is still lacking. The sex education in school does not speak about the spirituality, it does not speak about the soul, it does not speak about connecting to the unborn, it does not speak about the amount of people on the planet, or the consciousness development on the planet, or the prevention of diseases on the planet. They basically say that yes, it is possible, and yes, it is allowed, and just follow the rules, and thereby they most often think of the rules of law and the rules of moral judgment. But as I said, many of those rules of moral judgment have an adverse purpose, which is that of regulation of propagation, thus control of the population and the species, which is not the proper way to do it. And the fourth part of the story will go into that. What kind of consciousness development is possible and then comes into play. But as long as we don't have that, the awareness and understanding of sexuality is very primitive indeed, as we at the moment can see in the massive amounts of pornography on the internet and elsewhere. It is the kind of sexuality where sex is not understood, and where the relationship between the individual and the body is not understood, and where the relationship between the one sex partner and the other sex partner is not understood. So for me, it was logical that I needed to go and look into the body, what happens, because I could see that in society there is no good description. Actually, what is described there doesn't function well. In biology, we can find an excellent description. In fact, it is so encompassing that we might have difficulty to see how it relates to us. But when we look in our body, then we can see that things become very clear, very precise. So there are a couple of aspects that for me are relevant in looking at what happens in sex in the body. And here I would like to focus on the onset of sexuality in puberty, because that is where we can most clearly see what sex is, because we can see the difference with respect to what apparently sex is not before the onset of puberty. But we can also relate the onset of sexuality to this change of relationship in society. We can see that the onset of sexuality is actually also the pivot where we can relate the human to humanity, because the male and the female together can produce a new human, which either alone cannot do. So we can see that in sexuality, it's actually the complementarity between the male and the female, which then can lead to the continuation of the species. So in that sense, sex is not something that benefits the individual, but it certainly does benefit the species. In the fourth part of the story, I will come back to some insight that can show that sex can really do benefit the individual, but that will only work if the individual does that from the perspective of the species, from the transcendental knowledge. But before we can get there, it is necessary, I think, to go back a bit to explain what the onset of sex is, and what plays a role there in the relation between neurons and hormones, and then also with the understanding of how in the sexual interaction there is a shift from, say, chemical physiology to electrical physiology. And that is also the threshold where the bodily process, say the chemistry, then goes into the radio process, the interactive process of the electrophysiology. The story of sexuality and the act of sex needs to start with the act of sex. At the moment that you're born out of the fusion of sperm and egg. And as I described in the previous episode of this story, you have two parents, each of which has two parents, each of which has two parents, each of which has two parents. And if you go back far enough, you had more ancestors than there are people of on Earth. So in that sense, you can realize and appreciate that the mate that your one ancestor found in the other brought together the genetic information of the one with the other. So in their genetic information, they have all of the experience of life which were added to their DNA by the Lipton principle described in the previous episode. So all the new information was added to the DNA. You got one strand of DNA from the mother, one strand of DNA from the father. So between them you have a lot of survival solution, but also a lot of survival near-death trauma memories which are passed on into your gene. And those two strands of linear DNA connect to the strand of circular, or the double strand of circular DNA, which essentially has the information of life and survival on Earth. So the circular DNA is about the capacity to live and survive on Earth, while the linear DNA is more about the life and survival through circumstances. So in the ancestral memory you have a lot of solution, also a lot of unresolved issues which you better clean up. And if you combine all of that information from all of your ancestors, you see that every time an ancestor selected a mate for copulation and for having sex, then that selection which they did determined the capacities and the potentials, but also the limitations and the problems for the offspring. So in that sense, the parents need to learn to not just say, well, this is a handsome guy or this is a pretty girl and let's go and have sex, but they also need to look at the behavior of this partner is actually toxic to humanity, let's not have sex. Or the greediness of this partner, the non-sharing of resources, is actually not good for humanity. It might be good for the family, but let's reconsider if we can't find a better partner for this. In that sense, just like the dog breeders, the horse breeders, the tulip breeders, and the pharaohs all know that you can select properties and capacities in humans. And if you are aware that you do this, of course you will be very careful about whom you will have sex with and whom you will not have sex with. And also evidently there need to be laws that protect everybody, that if there is a forceful sex, then evidently you must be able to immediately terminate this, because this is rape. And that is a denial of freedom of choice. And anybody who denies freedom of choice for a sex partner will also do that to other people, will also do it to society. So those are not the kind of people that you want to have as the foundation of a healthy society. Because a healthy society, just as I described in the previous episode of biology, it needs to be very diverse, very inclusive, very encompassing, and very specific, and being able to move in all directions. And rape and denial of freedom of choice is not a part of the core of the principle of life. So once you understand that all of your ancestors contributed possibilities and limitations into your being, you know that that is what you work with, and that is what you will propagate in the continuation of your life if you have sex. So yes, there are many cautions about having sex, and many moral, social rules about selectivity of a sex partner. But as I mentioned in the first episode of this sequel, the rules of partner selection have been become dominated by the desire for ownership and exclusivity, and in fact disempowerment of other people at for the benefit of your own being, and that is very much propagated in the philosophy of Darwin and Galton and the whole eugenic philosophy of life, while in the approach of Lamarck and also Lynn Margulis we can see that we need to be able to overcome the limitations. We need to able to go from shortages to sharing. We need to able to go from greed to generosity. We need to understand that we need to operate as humanity as a whole in mutual support, so that together we can create the optimal situation for life on Earth, in the same way as we see that the cells in our body create the optimal platform for you to be able to express what you do on Earth, and sexual expression is part of that. So I'd like to come to an understanding from the start, from the conception of the body to the puberty, in the way that the curve of life and the curve of orgasm are actually related. And it's intriguing that if you look at the curve of orgasm, with the latent phase, the onset phase, the plateau phase, and the collapse phase, then you can in the same way see that it is actually also the graph of a lifetime of an individual. You have the latent phase of babyhood, then it's sort of the childhood phase of onset of building up a kind of life, then puberty, adulthood, a kind of lifestyle which is in balance with the environment, until by disease or death the system collapses. In the fourth part of the story we'll actually see how from the understanding of the graph of orgasm in relationship to the graph of life, we can see that the male and the female can, let's say, offset the graphs of the one to the other, and instead of having the graph of orgasm collapse at the end, it builds up. And specifically the Taoist forms of sexuality, and also some of the tantric forms of sexuality, are very much aware of that, that you can actually use the plateau phase of orgasm to create a new base level of your lifestyle, so that orgasm has in a way become a lifestyle, and then you can build up on that to have a higher, more encompassing level of orgasm, and in that way continue the curve of the build-up of sex without the collapse. You actually pair the male and the female response in the orgasm process, so that they, like a laser beam, start to lock into each other and continue on each other. But before we can get into that, it is necessary to start with a more basic understanding of sexuality, which is that it all starts in the first cell. So in the first cell there is already all of the information of what is being propagated from the ancestors into your body. And it is the work of Jaap van der Waal who shows that we need to understand what happens at the process of conception. But before we go into that, I'm sorry, I don't remember the author of the study on the fertilization process itself, so I need to go back to that. Essentially we need to start with the understanding of how conception starts, first, and that's also part of the fourth episode of this story, you need to have compatibility between the sex partners. A body, mind, soul and spirit all need to be connected. Being drunk on prom night is not a good enough excuse to have a sexual experience. If you need sexual experience, rather please first get sexual awareness. Rather please also first get sexual training, like dry training, dry swimming, like in Tantra or Taoistic training, so that you first know what your own body does before you start to cross-connect it to the body of another, and you need to tune in and find out how that works. So let's leave that to part four of the story for now and start with after the moment of ejaculation. Then the sperm will go into the vagina and will try to go for the egg, but there's two things that need to be carefully considered. First of all, when the sperm is released, it gets a lunch bag along, and it gets a climate buffering along. So bicarbonate of soda is added to compensate for the acidity of the vagina, if that's the case, because the acidity and alkalinity of the vagina has a lot to do with the balance of gender selection. And there's a book of sexual astrological birth regulation which goes into the details of how the seasons of the planets and the rhythms of the moon can determine what propensity there is for male or female offspring, simply because as a result of that in the body there will be a more acidic or more alkaline base setting for the body. So once you know that, and then it is clear that the bicarbonate of soda, which is sent along with the sperm, is for the survival of the sperm in an otherwise potentially too acidic climate. But there's also the fructose that comes along, so that the cells actually have some fuel while they move. But once they're out on their pathway, it is the body of the female that determines what happens. Actually, it was a female anthropologist who studied all of this, because she was, let's say, a bit fed up with this Roman notion that the sperm dictates all. You only need one sperm to fertilize the egg, and essentially it's a macho experience. She found quite the opposite. She found that the female body orchestrates what happens. The female body orchestrates which of the four forms of motion the sperm will take. Are they swimming like a fish? Are they moving like a flip-flop of a fish on the dry land? Are they moving like a corkscrew trying to penetrate into what lies ahead? Or are they waiting? So it's the electrical chemistry of the body of the female which decide all of that, while the sperm as a whole functions as a group. It's not the first come, first serve, race out, and the winner of the race. It is in fact the opposite. It is a bit like a peloton of cyclists in a race. They will move, one goes ahead, the other goes ahead. So the ones who are most powerful go to the front. When they are tired, they go a bit more to the rear so that they can go on in the slipstream of the others. And that together they form this cloud which will ultimately then reach the egg. The story of the egg by itself is already fascinating, because the oocyte, the organs that produce the eggs, actually produce around 12 eggs per session. And it's a bit like the Greek story of the warriors that were sown on the beach, where the first warrior that came out would turn around and kill the other warriors that emerged out of the beach. And in that way, the eggs that come out of the oocyte, say around a dozen, say around the zodiac full of them, around the in the season of the full moon will come out, and they go through a series of layers from the core of the oocyte to the outside of the oocyte, and as they come out, basically the ones that come out will shut off the ones that are still coming out, unless it is the other way around. And at some at the end, out of these dozen of egg cells, there will be one, maybe two left over. From there, they fall into the cavum Douglasii, which is at the bottom of the pelvis, and there it turns out that the water is of the same kind of salinity as the primordial ocean of Earth. So in that sense, in us, we still carry the primordial ocean of Earth. And then the fallopian tube, the fimbriae, reach into that water, and it can even reach to the other side of the body to get it out of that primordial ocean. And like an anemone, suck it up and bring it into the meeting point where the sperm then will connect up with it. So please look into the details of this, because I can now very briefly describe the story, but once you take the time to let it soak into your mind, you can see that the egg are actually the kind of macho approach in the whole story, and the sperm are the kind of female, let's do it together, approach to the story, until and they come together, and then in the coming together, the sperm will surround the egg, and for a period of around 4 hours, the sperm and the egg will hover around each other in an interaction, as has been described by Jaap van der Wal, embryologist. His website is embryo.nl, English version of that as well. And as he describes, in the lifespan of the sperm and the egg, each lives for around 3 days, then to have 4 hours of, say, a courting ritual, a mating dance, is an enormous long time span. And in that 4 hours, there is a calibration taking place of the sperm versus the egg. And the sperm is like a large ball, or like a resonator, like a sphere, like a ring in three dimensions. And the sperm is like a little string in one dimension. And so there is an electrochemical interaction between them, as a result of which the most compatible sperm can be filtered out. And the most compatible sperm will then be able to fuse with the egg. And at that point you have this opposition between the egg, which is very large, one of the largest cells in the human body, the sperm, which is very small, one of the smallest cells in the human body. And in the egg, the DNA which is there is hyper extended. It is really unfolded along. It can swim in this enormous bath, while in the sperm the DNA has been compressed like a sort of dry freezing state. Some people with their strange way of thinking compare to a nuclear warhead in a torpedo. So it's all compressed at the front end of the sperm, with the engine behind it with the tail to whip it into motion. So the sperm is a very compact vehicle for transporting this very compressed DNA. When the sperm and the egg are tuned, and the sperm is sort of connected up, the selected sperm is connected up to the egg, the membrane of the front of the sperm opens up, like the hatch open, the hood opens, but as a result, the skin of the sperm merges with the skin of the egg. And that leads to a crystallization, quite literally, of the skin of the egg. So there's the crystallization reaction, as a result of which other sperm can no longer enter. So in that sense, the egg shell freezes over, a bit like with the chicken when the egg goes from the oviduct of the chicken where it is still malleable, pliable plastic, it goes out into the air and then only then hardens. Then likewise, when the sperm skin fuses with the skin of the egg, the surface freezes over, becomes blocked for other sperm. The DNA, which is in the core head of the sperm, is now on the inside of the DNA. The tail can sort of fall off, and the compact DNA and the hyperextended DNA, like a Laurel and Hardy, can come together and need to tune into each other, emerge. That is a process of attunement, which is at the electrochemical level, because evidently the DNA is a very large molecule with many atoms, and as tetrionics shows, these are all patterns of information, and it's a signal for communication. So these two need to match, and they need to merge, they need to attune. So while that happens, the egg then starts to move from the meeting point at the edge of the fallopian tube and through the fallopian tube to the isthmus. And the isthmus is a narrow point in a fallopian tube going up to the womb, and it's like a ring pass knot. If the egg has hyperextended, it will not pass through that ring, so it cannot nestle into the uterus, and in fact it cannot grow. So there is a downward regulation that if the egg is growing much faster, much larger than could be expected, that the process is aborted. In fact, it is estimated that about 40%, 42 or 47%, I forget, of the conceptions would naturally, spontaneously abort. So there are many selective filtering mechanisms on what can happen. And then once the fertilized egg, the zygote, gets into the womb, it will nestle into the surface of the womb, as a result of which it will, say, part out and part in, be nestled in there, and will be given a, say, a root system, which will ultimately lead to the blood vessels feeding into the placenta, which then has a connection to the egg, which can then grow into the body. So right from the start, there is this symbiosis with the body of the mother, who already coordinated and orchestrated how the sperm came into her system, and who, with the connection of the primordial ocean and anemone kind of agility, were able to put the whole system in motion. And all of those principles are already part of that sexual activities schema, which we can then also see later on at the moment that sexuality has become unfolded from that first fertilized egg. In the process of the womb, which is a wonderful story in itself, you can then see that on the one side, where the egg cell complex is most free, it will form the heart, after which it will move to the inside. But as Blechschmidt, the physiologist, embryologist, showed, actually there's first a circulation and then the heart forms. So first there is this internal process, after which the organs will manifest that specific process. In this process, you can see that the cells will divide again and again, and first like a bunch of grapes, until it sort of forms a ball, after which it starts to extend in a bubble. Right in the early onset, there is a double system of sexual genital systems which are being developed. the Müller and the Wolf duct. Müller is like the Miller, it's a more female activity. Wolf like the wolf, the more male. So you can already infer what kind of direction that would go, even though they were named after the discoverers. So the Müller ducts will go into the female genital system and the Wolf duct will go into the male genital system, but the decision between the one and the other is actually based on how the X chromosome of the female decides on the XY chromosome from the male, and the female actually will decide which sex will be turned on and how it will be turned on. So that was the book Der Mann, Ein Irrtum der Natur, who nicely presented that again it's the female system that decides what happens. So out of that you can then understand that the sexual system is put in place very early in the development of the body, and actually the egg cells are already prepared all at that phase, and they will be released only later until the supply runs out, and that release starts in puberty. So having detailed the sexual interaction and say the complementarity and duality of it all right from the start and in the moment of conception, then we can also understand that that duality is only made more explicit at the moment that puberty sets in. The onset of puberty of course has relationship to the rhythms of astrology. The books of Lawrence Edwards neatly show how the planets in their conjunctions influence different rhythms in nature, and evidently the menstrual cycle is very clearly connected to the lunar cycle. So it is evident that there are all kind of rhythms in our body which are related to the rhythms in our environment, which are due to the rhythm of the seasons, which are due to the rhythms of the planets. So we can see that there is a lot of connectedness between the body rhythms, but also the rhythms of bodily development. So when puberty sets in, it is a transition from one level of functioning to another. There are 7-year cycles, as have been described in astrology. They correspond to the 7 weeks of the lunar cycle. The lunar cycle corresponds to the cycle of Saturn. So there are all kinds of rhythms in our body which are described in biochronology and the chemistry of diurnal rhythms in the body. So the organs will have specific rhythms in which they are more or less active, and that is also something that is seen in Chinese medicine. It is these rhythms and the relationship between rhythms and the way the rhythms build up between each other that there is a shift in the body at puberty, at which time there will be an accentuation of the sexual hormones. And be aware that the sexual hormones of the testosterone, the estrogens, progesterone and the others, they're actually one cycle, just as once said with the work of Gaston Naasson, who discovered that the microbes, the virus, the fungus and the spores are actually variations to the same theme of different expressions of life in different circumstances. Likewise, the sex hormones are part of the same cycle. It is just that in the female, the cycle is completed all the way, while in the male, one of the interim stages becomes the end stage, which is that of the testosterone. There is a logic to this, and that has to do with the resonant frequencies of the molecules and the way the chakras are aligned in the spectrum of radio waves in the body. That's a part already described in the story of the chakras. And in the body we can see an enormous complexity of that, most of which is unknown by medical doctors, but were known in other forms of healing. So we can also see that in the body in development of the hormone onset. And then it is clear that by a slight shift of a hormone level in the body, pre-existing difference such as the Müller duct for which created vagina and the Wolf duct which created the penis system, testicular system, they become amplified and more pronounced. So at the onset of puberty, the women will start the formation of breasts, which is say the milk production site, but also a reserve of fat to be able to underbuild the energy needed for that. Well, in the men, you'll say see the beard and the testicular growth becoming more pronounced. These are all dual with respect to each other. So and when you look at the mathematics, they are complements of each other. They match up with each other, but they're just the other aspects of the same principle. They complement, complete each other. You cannot see that if you look only within the female or only within the male. You can only see that when you cross-correlate what happens between the male and the female. And again, in this book of Der Mann ein Irrtum der Natur, it nicely presents that women have 15% more fat in their body, so that they are more able to survive. And they can live longer, so they can preserve the species longer in times of survival stress. The men have 15% more muscle, so that they can muscle their way out of a situation into a different situation, so that at the moment that food is scarce, they can climb over the mountain and find something at the other side of the mountain and hopefully come back. Solutions like that. As was described in the Irrtum der Natur, men have 15% more muscle and they use that to dominate the female, which is not how it's meant to be. It is meant that with the 15% they can support the female by doing the things the female cannot do because it requires the 15% more muscle. So in that sense, in all the cultures, the men are depicted as the more muscular, the more active, the more decisive, which is to be able to go from one territory to another, while the female is portrayed as the more nurturing, the more persistent, the more enduring. They complement each other. So once the men start to support the women, start suppressing them, the women can create the conditions of survival in which both can thrive, and the man can add the new input which is necessary for them to thrive and to be able to create offspring. And that, by the way, is also what you see in the circular DNA, which is transmitted from female to child only, and it's only in the maternal line, as the Gypsies know and other cultures know as well. It's the maternal line of inheritance which determines that connectedness between people. And the male adds a linear DNA. Basically, that's the variation needed to be able to unfold the human DNA to more and different potential. So the female represents the stability of the system, and the male represent a necessary or useful or interesting variety to the system. So the females are fundamental for survival, and the males are merely an addition, an innovation, extension, or perhaps not even that. There are techniques by which the women can fertilize themselves, which is parthenogenesis. It's the virgin birth. In the laboratories, it was found that if you have a specific electrical charge and you prick the egg with a platinum needle, then it can actually kickstart itself. My hypothesis would be that the platinum needle would initiate a singularity in the electric field, as a result of which the field could fold in on itself, create a vortex by which the cell division could start. And of course you get a cloning with, of course, all of the errors in the previous system being continued in the next. That's also the role of the modulation mitigation, the moderation of the male sperm versus the female egg, that the male linear DNA will have a lot of sameness as the female DNA, and as a result they will reinforce each other. But there where there are discrepancies between the male and the female DNA, it might be that there are errors in the female DNA for which the male DNA could be the correction, or it could be the other way around, that those are errors in the male DNA for which the female DNA has the correction. In both cases it would be that whatever is shared and similar in the two strands of DNA will be the common threat of health, and what is not shared might be possible points of weakness or discrepancy of, or in any case places within the DNA where a confirmation of a solution is still needed. So that is where the male and the female DNA complement each other, and that's also how the male and the female could or would or should, let's get away from morality, in principle complement each other. There is so much complementarity between the male and the female that you can see how all of that comes together at the moment of the onset of sexuality, where suddenly the male and the female discover that they are no longer both children, dog, boy or girl, but that they are actually starting to shift with respect to each other, which of course evokes a kind of curiosity of what's the shift in the one and what's the shift in the other, and what is the meaning of that. At that time, at some point, the male and the female will discover that their arms have the length so that they can precisely touch their genitals, but as a result of this shift in hormones they will also discover that there is a change of sensitivity and a change of functionality in their genitals. So just as when you itch you scratch, then people will itch and scratch, and they will discover that by manual manipulation they can accentuate these sensations which they can have in their genitals. So it is only natural that people learn the art of masturbation. Masturbation is actually the Latin word for pole twirling, which could be better called self-gratification, which is also not a good word, but it sort of expresses that by the self-stimulation, which is the better word, you can get a stimulation feedback response of a kind of neuronal and hormonal accentuation which the body experiences as rewarding. So it's only normal and natural that people will discover that stimulation of the genital area feels rewarding. And in a normal, natural culture, the lads would discuss that with their lads, their friends, and the girls will discuss that with the other girls, their friends. They would compare notes, so they would have interactions by which they compare what they find in their masturbation with their own body in with respect to what their friends find. As you might have noticed, the Western world culture doesn't much do of that, so they don't realize that masturbation actually has very many versions, and that actually there are very specific patterns of self-stimulation which are not the same for everybody. There is a documentary series called OMG, Oh My God, which portrays a series of people describing their favorite techniques for self-stimulation, and that makes very clear how different people will have different rhythms, which in part correspond to the kind of personality types that there are. In Ayurveda and shamanism, you would call them the earth, water, air and fire elements. Some people are more into their internal sensations, some people have the opposite, that they are very much immersed with what goes on around them, and there are people who sort of reflect more on that, or who want to feel into that more. So likewise with the self-stimulation, people will have four of those kind of responses, and as a result people will not have the same kind of self-stimulation triggers for their optimized self-sensation. So if people would compare notes, then they would know that their experiences are different, but in many ways also the same. That's where I found it very helpful to read the story of the island of Truk, T-R-U-K. Try to remember the title of the book. And it was about the so-called primitive tribe, where at puberty all of the people would go into the longhouse, and the boys and the girls would live together and explore sexuality together. But as a result they could compare notes in how the self-stimulation worked, and of course compare notes between the boys and the girls as well. And then by having the understanding of how women self-stimulate in a different way than men, they would also know basically the foundation for the sexual interaction. In the Western culture not much attention is given to that, so how can the boys know how the girls best self-stimulate, and how do the girls best know how the boys best self-stimulate if they don't compare notes? And as some people said, it is as if in high school the boys are brought to a separate secret class where they learn about how girls work, and girls are brought to a secret separate class where they know how boys work, and then afterwards they're supposed to know, except nobody went to those classes. So everybody's left guessing, and especially in America there's a lot of teenage culture which still persists from the 1950s till now, where that kind of exploration was sort of explored. At some point it became very explicit, very clear as well. The hippie time was part of that, until it was lost again because of political influences, and also the, let's say, the killing of Wilhelm Reich. So boys and girls don't really know how the girls and boys function. So when they meet up, they essentially have to learn from scratch. Scratch in this case quite literally. They have to learn what the scratch stimulus response is in the other, but they also have to learn to discover how there are lag times and relay times and build up processes, so that as the body is stimulated it shifts gear and then responds differently to the stimulation. Just like in a car, when you go from one gear to the other, the response to the accelerator is different, the power that is available is different, and the way that you need to hit the brake also needs to be different. And this is where it's then helpful to understand that in the building up of the sexual interaction, it all starts with seeing and smelling and touching, and it has nothing to do with the genitals as yet, even though they might start to respond into that. But it is the more encompassing, the more the foundation is led in the seeing, the smelling and the touching of the whole body, the more platform there is for a whole body response to whatever happens at the genital level. I always found it very surprising that the orgasm explosion was so very, let's say, exorbitantly powerful or overwhelming, until I realized that it only seems overpowering if you're not at a meditative level. If you start with this level of the whole body involvement, the whole body experience, and you enter into the whole sexual interaction from, let's say, the perspective of meditation, full awareness, and you share that with a partner, and the partner too is in that level of full awareness, let's call it meditation, then at the moment that the sexual interaction builds up, and I'll come back to that in a bit, then it can lead to a fusion, say a peak point or a climax. And at that point, the shout of orgasm, the light beam of the orgasm, is like a weak bleep, which basically serves as the pulse for the synchronization between what happens in the body and the male of the male in relationship to what happens in the body of the female. So let's look a bit at what happens then in the building up of this process of the orgasm, from the premise of doing that from a whole body contact. In the descriptions on the topic, which basically started in the 1960s, 70s, with the Sheer Height Report, the McMaster's research, Kinsey studies, many of which came out of, say, a political or a communist political arena, because in a way there was this battle between communism and the church, where the church said stay away from sex, and the communists said, well, actually we all experience sex, so let's find out. So a lot of research was being done, and first of all it was discovered that everybody had the same secrets. Secondly, everybody had the same kind of physiological response, which went much further than most people had ever explored. Thirdly, there was a much wider range of strange sexual behavior, which in retrospect turned out to be amplified, because this was by people who were trying to find the course, but in a way got lost a bit in what else there was, and that was just a part of the discovery of limitations, so to say. And only after that came the insight that actually perhaps there's something more to this than just a pure physiological or psychological orgasmic scream in mind and body. So I'll come back to that in the fourth part of the story. But in the research which was being done, it became clear that, first of all, everybody was sexual. Secondly, everybody at some point discovered that they were sexual. Forget about whatever system there was for denying it. Thirdly, people would be willing to explore their sexuality, some more, some less, some excessively, some not at all, depending on their religious or political upbringing. Fourthly, it turned out that actually the sexual principle was the same for everybody. So out of that came the studies, the graphs, the publications, and the institutes which then continued the sexual research, even though now they seem to be less visible, because in a way the sexual freedom has been turned into a commercial interesting industry of pornography and other variations to the theme. And that's also why I'll come back to the other view on that in the fourth part of this sequel. But even though sex has been made very explicit, it still has not become very much understood. So that was the kind of dilemma I was looking at when I started to study this. Because my medical training was definitely very incomplete. My social cultural upbringing was very incomplete. What schools have since begun to offer is very limited, and in fact in that sense also very restrictive, because it looks more at the physical or the psychological or the social part of it, but not the spiritual part of it. So I sort of had to go back to basics and find out what it's all about. And that's, as I said before, where these graphs of the plateaus of orgasm became very handy, because it described that there is a sort of dormant base level, then the line curves up in the excitation initiation, had the onset of stimulation, then it builds up to the curve slopes back down again into a plateau phase, where it is as if the excitation cannot go much further than that. And at some point, for most people, by accident seemingly, there will be an orgasm and there will be an ejaculation, and that will be it. When you look into the Taoist books, such as by Mantak Chia, you can see that that's only very much the beginning of the story. And in that sense, I would like to go back to the beginning of the story and sort of look at the sexual interaction response from the larger perspective. As I mentioned, it is very good to start with the circumstances. Huh? You need to have the setting in nature, the setting in culture, then the room, the space that you're in, then the exploration of how you feel, the poetry, the song, the music, the candles, then the touching of the body, the slowly tuning into the body, the slowly making more contact with the body until the whole body starts to be awake, and the surface of the body starts to become alert, that the focus is, it's like in meditation, that instead of focusing on what happens around you, the focus is on what happens on the skin, on the body level, in the body, but in contact with the other, so that there is a next level of what are actually these shifts of feelings and emotions and these electrical phenomena that we sense as pulsations or vibrations or titillations or whatever. And then at some point how they merge in, and how, say, the flashes of light turn into a glow, a bit like sparks of light can build up a laser beam. There are many components that come together. In fact, it is the same way as the organs together digest the food, and the sensory organs together integrate our experience, that in sexuality, all of the senses, when they are activated, and they will be able to work with a whole range of vibrations in and around the body. So everything starts to feed into that process. The sensory organs are complemented by the digestive organs. So they, as Chinese and Indian medicine show, are actually part of the same system. So they turn on, and their rhythms, which are slower than the sensory system rhythms, will start to play along, and the whole body will start to shift. And that's best described as the relationship between the neuronal impulses of the sensation feeding into the hormonal responses of, let's say, the digestive system, but also the other way around, that the shift of the hormonal system will change the firing rate and the firing frequencies and firing range of the neuronal system. So the neuronal system shifts the hormonal system, and the hormonal system shifts the neuronal system. And in both cases, it means that the functioning of the body is not so much chemical anymore, but it's more electric. So the electric part of the hormones becomes more important, and the electric part of the neurons become more important. This has been nicely described by the work of Cyril Smith, who essentially says that the neurons are the telephone wires, and the hormones are the postal parcel delivery system, and you need both, and the more you use it, the more you can communicate. So in the build-up of the orgasm, there is the same pattern of the sensory system and the digestive system, in that it starts with the physical contact, and then it goes into the physiological response. For the male and the female, actually, there is a complementarity in that. then it goes into a neuronal activation. Again, for the males it's the opposite, and then it comes together in a consciousness shift. I've come to compare it to the digestive system, because there too, when we take in food, first we chew it, we physically chew it, we mash it up. So the first part of the sexual interaction is the physical, is not the chewing, but it is the contact, it's the vibrations, it's the massage, it's getting rid of the charges, the tensions in the body, so that the body is no longer in stress response to anything that happens. So that's where the massage comes in, that's where the acupressure points come in, that's where the specific glandular meridian points come in, that's where the neural consciousness triggers of the acupressure points come in, but that's also where candles, scents, touch all come into play to wake up the body, but also to discharge the charges that were still in the body. It's very much the physical part of the story, like the chewing of the food. From the mouth, we then swallow the food, and it goes to the stomach, where the acid is doing the chemical breakdown of what happens. And in our sexual exploration, it is then too, from the physical, there is a shift in the sensation, because the massage of the body actually leads to a shift in bodily sensation. People who have had shiatsu massage experiences will know that after the massage, it's like the body has opened up, that the body is larger, it is more fluffy, it is more sensitive, it is slower in response, but much clearer in response. So in the sexual interaction, it's the same, but after the physical interaction, and again whole body and the penis vagina contact are both physical, but the penis vagina, which is like the antenna in the middle of the radio dish for the signal communication, needs to have the support of the whole body response of the radio dish in order to work well. So to connect the genitals is meaningful only if the whole body has been discharged. But the connection of the genitals and the interaction, say the massage at the genital level, which creates a stimulus response of neuronal excitation. But the neuronal excitation needs to be meshed in into the rest of the body. It needs to be felt as a body response, not as a local response. And that's why the whole body needs to be activated first, and that's why the process needs to be slowed down so much that if the woman is the lead on the process, the man needs to slow down to the sensation of the body of the female. Then in the female, the hormonal system, which is predominant there, marginally but decisively dominant, will actually determine the rhythms, and that will actually, let's call it the Pavlov effect, orchestrate the relationship between the organs, but also it can shift the relationship between the organs. That's where the body is no longer physiological but psychological. And that's also where having discharged the tensions in the muscles of the system, it is then possible to discharge the emotions of the system. That's why women always need to have this long contact, because they need to calibrate the feelings, and they need to chew out the feelings which are not compatible, and that's why the man needs to follow the female. Otherwise the woman needs to simply refuse the male and say, okay, if you're not listening, then we can't talk. And if the guy does listen, then she can follow that digestion of the internal cycle of the feelings and the emotions, turning emotions into feelings, which is again dissolving the undigested experiences which play up, and if necessary to pause or interrupt the sexual interaction and say, well, actually what came up is this, to resolve that and use kinesiology or hypnosis or NLP techniques or whatever to reposition those traumatic or memory events which came up so that they are resolved. And then the process can be continued or, if necessary, restarted until that level of the fullness of the experience of the organic level comes in. And so for the male, that's a bit like swimming in murky water, because most males have not learned to do that. And it's only by trusting the female that they can get to that level to learn that and feel that. And once they do that, they can discover that actually switches in a hormonal level in the female will actually release and switch levels within them. In my first experience of that, I suddenly discovered that I was walking 12 inches off the floor for a couple of days, because the hormonal shift switch in the female had released corresponding patterns within me, which I didn't know, but the woman could feel. So she's not just digesting her own emotional level, but also that of the male. And by doing that, and that does take time, there is this next platform where the cycle of the organ and the feelings and emotions are the emotions are turned into feelings, and the cycle of the emotion becomes the blood circulation. It is the feeling of an ongoing circulation. It's no longer going from one feeling to the other, or from one color to the other, from one tone to the other, but it goes to a consistent hum. And then in that consistent hum, there is speeding up. It's like a vortex turning on itself. And that's where the female process then goes into the hormonal, from the hormonal process into the neuronal process, which is where the male starts to recognize more of it. But still, he needs to follow what happens rather than run away with it, for the simple reason that if he runs away with it, he'll just fire up his ammunition and lose the charge. It is all about building up the charge beyond that neurological event. So it needs to build up, and that's where the male then needs to sort of be the brake on the system, and because the males normally operate more at that level, so the male will be able to slow down that process and guide it more, so that it fires up the whole of the body instead of just burning out through the middle of the core like a firecracker exploding. Instead, it needs to be the fuel of the internal bath, and that the Chinese say this very much depends on how the male understands this, and they compare the female body to a bath filled with water, and the male working this energy as straw fire, the fire of twigs, the fire of chunks of wood, or the fire of coal. And as you can imagine, straw fire will burn excessively intensely for a very brief moment, but it will not heat up the bath water. If the man uses the slowing down of the energy, the breathing combined with the chi, to feed it into the whole body instead of letting it explode, he can get it into the level of the twigs, but then he still needs to realize that he's only heating up one part of the bath and the rest stays cool. Then if the man realizes that he actually needs to focus on the energy and hold it together like a large chunk of wood, then he can actually build the fire to heat up the bath as a whole. But what he then still needs to realize is that he actually needs to quench the fire in the wood and turn it into a glow, so that the wood turns into coal, and then the coal can keep the bath water warm. And in that way, the neuronal energy can be regulated by the male, so that it becomes a glow and it becomes the counterpart of the hum that the female has achieved by dissolving all these emotions, turning them into a feeling, and having the effect of the organ come together as the circulation of, let's say, the blood flow in the body. So she has achieved the circulation, the male has achieved the circulation, and these two loops then come together, and then they can interlock and they can resonate and it's a bit like two radio coils. They can between them suddenly open up to the space around, and that's where the male and the female start to feel what they're feeling, and that might require a restart of the whole sexual intercourse, because it could be that there's physical trauma that is felt, that there's emotional trauma or social psychological trauma that's felt, or existential life trauma, depending on where they are having blocks in our system, if it is in their life experience or in their memory banks or in their ancestral memory banks or in the core DNA memory banks. There might be levels to work through, and the more of these blockages that are worked through, the more the antenna opens up. It's as if these two antenna rings can get closer and closer and closer together, and they need to stay apart, but they get closer together, so they speed up, and it's like their frequency range or the radio range or the consciousness range expands. So they will feel more of each other, they will feel more into the future and the past, they will feel, as I mentioned in the previous section, they can have the possibility to contact the unborn, and all the kind of paranormal psychic phenomena which have been described in the mystic trainings, which are so loudly denied by the thought control groups, come into play. And yes, these are very subtle things, that's why they call subtle energies. They're powerful things that are called energies, but in fact they're consciousness. And so out of the sexual interaction, it is possible to gear up to totally different levels of consciousness. And the next part of the story will address that. For now, I just wanted to summarize that in the sexual interaction between the male and the female, there is this duality between the hormonal level and the neuronal level. So that is where you also need the opposite sexes, where in the female there is this greater propensity of processing through the hormonal, so a lot can work at the hormonal level, but also say at a multitasking level, say more the right brain functioning, while in the male it is more the neuronal level, which is also more the logical sequential processing, which is more the left brain. So suddenly you have the left brain and the right brain working together. It's like the stereo of two loudspeakers, where you can open the space with the whole orchestra in between them. But it's also like having the spark caught in a mirror, so that you can turn it into laser. In the brain, when the four brain halves, four left, right and rear, are connected up together, they do work like a hologram projector, as was described by Carl Pribram and Talbot and others. So in us we have immense potential to realize much more than we are aware of, and that change in realization has a lot to do with the shift in focus from where you would normally be at your forebrain of identifying with something, the left brain analyzing the relationship and how it relates to you or to others, the right brain and what it is in perspective to the background, or the rear brain, how it actually forms part of reality as a whole. In India, they call it Bhagavad Gita, with the forebrain being Arjuna, the rear brain being Krishna, the forebrain being the focus, the rear brain being the integration, front differentiation, rear integration. So in our brain we do all of that, but all of those processes we also use in the sexual interaction. In the sexual interaction we do not do it at the mental level, but we do it from the body level. And in our being, of course, we have body, mind, soul and spirit connected. So in the sexual experience, it is about the genital system, which is the second chakra, close to the first chakra, actually interfacing between the male and the female, so that the difference between self and other, which is the duality of the second chakra, can be complemented by the partner, so that the difference is overshadowed by the sameness. By having that sameness, the second chakra actually connects back to the first chakra, and so then both can experience the sameness in different bodies. So you can actually have a bridging between the two bodies and a sharing of consciousness between them. So that is where the whole understanding of sexuality in our body helped me to go to a much deeper level of understanding, because yes, there is this direct complementarity between the penis and the vagina, and as nature shows, it is all about the vagina and the capacity to recreate and procreate, and the penis gives a variation to that. So yes, it is very important that the female decides which male would be a compatible, computable partner. And then, of course, it is very specific and significant that the sperm can actually be transferred by a penis, so that the female actually has grip on the situation and can be sure that it's the right sperm from the right penis from the right person, so to say. At that level, the biology of sexuality is very explicit, very specific, very precise. But that process of connecting penis and vagina is only the mechanical part of it. It then is about having the opposite effect of what Bruce Lipton described, that you have an experience outside of the cell. The sensory protein catches that. The portal protein allows it in. The linking protein has already decided that it is a good idea to do so. And then the DNA mantle protein writes it into the DNA. Now, in the sexual experience, it is the DNA is already there, but now it needs to be connected back to the linking protein. The meaning of the DNA in the perspective of the life of that, let's say, the male partner, needs to be clear. What are the feelings around that? Which are the unresolved emotions around that? Then the next level, do you take it in, yes or no? The neural system needs to filter if there are issues in the consciousness development level which still need to be addressed or resolved. And then finally, the fourth phase is that the sensor protein, that it is the consciousness field that then will be the basis for the interaction. So when you look at it from that side, the process of copulation starts with a physical stimulus, which then can lead to a physiological felt response, which then leads to a neuronal change of activation of the body and also of consciousness, which then leads to a shift in consciousness. And it is about that, because you first need to be able to learn to operate at that level before you can then link back to a decision, which then can link back to the process, which can then link back to the activity of an ejaculation and conception. So that's one of the reasons why in so many religions they say, well, be a bit careful about this sex stuff, because it's not just about getting sperm on board, but it's getting the sperm with the right intent, the right purpose, and the right effect. But you can only get there if you can actively go to that fourth plateau level of the sexual interaction of orgasm. And that is precisely what Wilhelm Reich described. He started with the study of sexuality in a university and discovered that medical school does not address sexuality, specifically not the experience of sexuality. Then, as a medical practitioner in the area of the poor, he realized that there were a lot of pregnancies and problems around sexuality And that's where he discovered that a lot of people don't actually have an orgasm. They might have an ejaculation, but they don't have an orgasm, and they don't have orgasmic potential, which is that capacity to linger at that level of full orgasm, at that level of consciousness, from the physical to the physiological to the neurocrine to the consciousness level. And so that's where he then discovered that once you have that higher level of the electromagnetic field, which he called the orgone, which the Chinese would call it qi and the Nordics would call the od, it's the electromagnetic communication between the cells by which the cells attune what they do. Once you start to operate at that level, you start to interact with the level where the body regulates. And if you do that in the sexual interaction, you actually do that in co-processing with the body of another. So suddenly you can become aware of these electromagnetic domains. But that electromagnetic domain is only the carrier wave of the information level of the consciousness that is beyond that. So that's where Wilhelm Reich discovered that we have all these frequencies in our body. So he realized that orgasm is not just physical, but it's an electrophysiology. In fact, the electromagnetic effect extends beyond us, and that's why he developed the Cloudbusters and the Rainmaker devices. But he also realized that it transcends dimensions, and that is where he discovered that he could have contact with other forms of consciousness. Which is where the people who believe in control politics and domination and suppression of other people decided that he was not allowed to speak about these things, because they fell back on this domination by sexual repression. But if you look at the work of Wilhelm Reich, if you read his works and the works that have been created around him, you can see that that is where you can very clearly see the relationship between the physical aspect of sexuality through the relational aspect of sexual reality in the interrelational sexual experience, so that you actually transcend the sexual reality or the sexual experience, and it turns into a consciousness effect. And that's why in the starting of the story I also said, well, a lot of this needs to be understood from the level of tetradonics and how the quantum field interacts with matter, because this is where you actually then go back to interacting with the quantum field by having created such a resonant and harmony in matter that it all tunes, and that like a musical composition you can build one note up on top of the other and can go to a very complex and refined phase coherence in the music. That essentially is what the physical process of sexual development is about. That in our body we turn on a machinery for communication and sensitivity, which was built in right at the start. That's why I needed to refer to this moment of conception and the moment of the moments around that, where sperm and egg come together, how they interact and how they're actually filtered before they can form the body with the sexual polarities already seemingly built in, which is then later activated, which is then later turned on, and which can then be later experienced or used but also abused in the sexual interaction. And that's where sex is such a fascinating and powerful experience, but also where it is very important to be selective whom you have sex with and what kind of sex you have with them. Because getting beyond the level of mutual masturbation is not very helpful unless you need to get rid of some charge discharge in the body. Because at that level, let's say pure crude sexual charge discharge, as it is used in some corporate office spaces, the drunk Christmas office parties, can be helpful to charge discharge. But again, as Dan Winter says, you never have a one-life stand, you have that memory for a lifetime. So whoever you have sex with, you actually merge with them, fuse with them. So if you're not careful who you have sex with, you do get that kind of effect into your body. And nowadays you would say, like with a memory stick for a computer, if you don't know where it's been, don't put it in, which is also the motto for sexually transmitted diseases. But it also applies to the character and the behavior and the life experiences of people. So yes, there is a lot to know before you actually go to deep end of sex. And like walking, yes, people will fall before they need to get up again, but it's not about the falling, which was the part accentuated in the church approach. It is about getting up, which is what we see in the history of biology. So I'd like to round off this part of the story here and summarizing that if you look into the biology of sex, specifically in the physiology of sex in our body, and then you can see that physiology and biology are intimately connected. And if you want to look that up, Bert Verveen has described that in his system Pathophysiology. So that we are actually living the whole biology in our body, in our physiology, connected to our psychology. And in the next section of this series, I would then like to go into say the magic of sex, which is most explicitly about how the shift in consciousness in sexuality is something that people can learn to use, and which in fact people have also learned to operate in what is called the schools of mysticism. But the schools of mysticism are always based on the experiences that people had within their own body, in the relationship between consciousness and the body. And if that is with sex or without sex, the principle is always the same. And by the connection of, say, spirit and matter, on consciousness and the body, you will discover that you're actually connected to the universe as a whole. And that's another reason why some churches said, well, in case people discover that they are God, then we might better tell them not to have sex, because that's a potential way to get to that realization that they are God. So as your life is your life and other people's lives is their life, you can listen to what other people have to say, and we can learn a lot from each other. But it's also good to be cautious when people say you cannot do something, because you need to know if that serves their agenda, and in fact that they are not helping you but hurting you or harming you or limiting you. When you look in the body, you can actually find out how it works. So whatever anybody might say or think or claim, if you look in the body, you will find it out. And if you study the biology, as you can do through biology, physiology, understanding the medical perspective of the body, then you can get into that deeper level where you can see how it all connects and why sex is such a powerful key in relating information and matter, because actually it works on that interface. So I'll conclude this storytelling for now, and in the next part I will then go into what can happen once you realize that sex is not physical but psychological, in fact spiritual.